You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, the BBC News, followed by A Public Affair.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored community radio, WORT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. Donald Trump has insisted talks on a ceasefire in Ukraine are on track after he held an hour-long phone call with President Zelensky. Mr. Trump described the conversation as very good. Our correspondent Tom Bateman has more details from Washington.
President Trump spoke on the phone to Volodymyr Zelensky from the Oval Office, nearly 3 weeks after the Ukrainian leader was given his public dressing down there. The US president described the hour-long call as very good, saying much of it was based on yesterday's discussion with Vladimir Putin, as Mr. Trump tries to broker an end to the war. He said the call involved him trying to align both Russia and Ukraine in terms of their requests and needs. Both leaders have said they would agree to a halt to attacks on energy infrastructure, but Mr. Trump wants progress towards a wider truce.
Protests are taking place in Istanbul after the detention of the city's mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who's seen as the main political rival to Turkey's president. Hundreds of people chanting and waving flags gathered outside Istanbul's police station despite a ban on all protests and political meetings. The United Nations says one of its international staff has been killed when an explosive was dropped on or fired at a UN compound in central Gaza. It says one other person was killed in the same incident in Deir el-Bala. Speaking at a news conference, George Moreira da Silva, executive director of the UN Office for Project Services, confirmed the attack.
It's where we have our compound, our guest house, our premises in Gaza. It is understood that this UNOPS premises was hit at approximately 11:30 a.m. this morning.
The Israeli military has denied carrying out an attack there after resuming its bombardment of the Palestinian territory. The Israeli army now says it's extending its ground operations. A judge in New York has ruled that a student of Palestinian origin, Mohamed Khalil, who led protests at Columbia University against Israel's military campaign in Gaza, can challenge the legality of his arrest. From New York, here's Neda Taufik.
Judge Jesse Furman ruled that the case must be transferred to New Jersey, where Mahmoud Khalil was detained when his lawyers petitioned for his release. He left in place an order halting Mr. Khalil's deportation. The judge said this was a case where judicial review was critical because of plausible claims that the administration had violated the law or exercised its otherwise lawful authority in an arbitrary and discriminatory manner. The Trump administration has invoked a rarely used law to justify his deportation, claiming without providing evidence that he took part in pro-Hamas events that threaten U.S. foreign policy. Mr. Khalil denies that.
World News from the BBC. A British teenager who killed three members of his own family and planned a school shooting has been sentenced to a prison term of at least 49 years. Nicholas Prosper killed his mother, his 16-year-old brother and his 13-year-old sister. His aim had been to shoot dead an entire class of four-year-old school children and their teachers. Pakistan and Afghanistan have reopened their main border crossing after clashes between troops stationed there led to its closure for nearly a month. The Tolkien border point is the main artery for travel and trade between the two countries. An official said it will be initially open for trade and people will be allowed to cross on foot from Friday onwards. Malaysia has signed a deal with an American exploration firm to restart the search for the missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, which disappeared over a decade ago in one of the world's great aviation mysteries. A survey vessel will search a section of the Indian Ocean floor covering 15,000 square kilometres. And the European Space Agency has released the first tranche of data from its Euclid Space Telescope. Euclid is on a six-year mission to map the cosmos and potentially help scientists understand the nature of dark matter. More from Electron A. Smith.
Euclid has produced a goldmine of data, giving the world a glimpse of its power to peer into the cosmos. It scanned three patches of the sky, producing a mosaic of millions of distant galaxies with a detailed catalogue of almost 400,000 of them. Scientists say the data provide rare potential for understanding the nature of dark matter, the mysterious substance thought to make up most of the universe. But Euclid is not just a dark universe detective, it's also a time machine, an enabling researchers to look back through 10 billion years of cosmic history.
That's the latest BBC News.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them to celebrate the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. YWCA Madison is eager to gather with their community of supporters to share stories that speak to who they are and demonstrate their values of humanity, community, growth and restoration, which are at the heart of how they move as an organization. Attending the Circle fundraiser impacts the lives of thousands of women, children, and families who are served each year through YWCA's transformational programs in housing and shelter, employment and transportation, restorative justice, and learning and movement building. More information about the Circle fundraiser and other YWCA programs and resources can be found at ywcamadison.org. That's the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center. Keeping you informed of community events and resources, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
Good afternoon, Madison. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is a public affair. I feel like there was like more intro music than I thought there was going to be. I don't know why, but it's really like happy Wednesday, y'all. Happy rainy Wednesday. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is a public affair. Today we're talking with Emily Kalach. I'm sorry. I don't know if I know how to say your last name. Kalachi. Will you tell me?
Kalachi. Kalachi, yes.
That's a beautiful name. You are a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she teaches courses on African-American or on African history, reproductive politics, and global feminism. If you're, you know, interested in asking her questions about that work, please give us a call today at 608-256-2001. We'd love to hear from you. She recently wrote an incredible book, and that's what we're gonna talk a little bit about today. This book is all about unpaid labor and kind of questioning if folks should be compensated for labor that has been historically performed by women and folks of color and has been seen as unpaid and unskilled. Tell us a little bit about your book, Emily.
Sure. So my book is called Wages for Housework, The Feminist Fight Against Unpaid Labor. And it's a book that looks at this really interesting moment in feminism that I think has largely been overlooked. So in the 1970s, there's this group of women who came together and they made this really provocative demand. That is, you know, they demanded wages for housework. And, you know, it caused a lot of controversy at the time. This was the 1970s, the kind of beginning of what we think of as second wave feminism, when people are coming together, you know, in women's groups, asking how can we liberate women? You know, how can we, you know, improve women's lives and basically, you know, find freedom? And, you know, much of that movement was focused on the issue of rights, you know, right? Abortion rights, rights to equal pay for equal work, all these really critically important struggles. But the women in this group that I'm writing about, Wages for Housework, argued that actually that doesn't go far enough, because while all these rights are really important, it doesn't address a fundamental injustice and inequality in our society, which is economic injustice. The fact that so much of the work necessary make society function, to make the economy function, is work that is largely invisible, unrecognized, and done for free. So raising children, caring for the elderly and the sick, keeping our environments healthy. Without this work, you know, the economy would just grind to a halt in a second. We learned this in the pandemic, right? But that work, you know, is done for free, you know, by women. Until you get to that root problem, you know, you can't address the other, you know, major issues that lead to inequality. So by demanding wages for housework, you know, they were asking, you know, at the most basic level for a paycheck. But beyond that, they were really trying to push us to think differently about how we organize our society and to imagine what kind of world we could live in if we actually compensated and valued that work.
I mean, I think this is such a radical notion, and it's interesting to think that it's historically placed. And it's also, there's the deep tragedy of your book for me was that because the book has this historical perspective, it was very clear that the idea that we've come so far is highly debatable. highly debatable whether or not, like, it feels like we're still fighting for reproductive rights. Women are dying across the country right now because they're being denied access to medically necessary care during pregnancy. You know, we are still fighting for equal pay for equal work. It felt amazingly relevant to this moment. And it was exciting to read a book that felt like this clear line of connection between modern women and the women who gave birth to us.
Absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about why you chose to hone in on this aspect of feminism.
Sure. You know, it really kind of started from a personal experience in my life, which is I became a parent for the first time. And, you know, like a lot of parents, you know, nothing really prepares you for how overwhelming an experience it is. It's joyful. It's sublime. It's amazing. It's also really difficult, exhausting, sometimes disgusting, sometimes really boring. It's just incredible amount of work. And, you know, I think it was the first time that I really recognized, you know, how this work is happening everywhere. And, you know, like many new mothers, I got just all this advice about, like, how do you manage this new workload? How do you do this double shift? You know, how do you get work-life balance and, you know, become more efficient? And all that advice is really meaningful and important, and I really benefited a lot from a lot of it. But I felt frustrated because I felt that all that advice was really tailored to me as an individual. And I really found myself just kind of like hungry for bigger ideas, you know, for all of us, right? To think about, why do we do things this way? Why do the people who, you know, are doing all this really important work, why are many of them among the poorest in our society? Why don't we compensate this work? Why do we try to make it seem like solving this problem should be an individual lifestyle hack rather than a systemic thinking about how we might do things differently and support that work? So thinking through these questions in my own life, it led me to look at, you know, how have feminists in the past thought about this question of unpaid work? I mean, you know, when I was growing up in the 90s, we didn't really talk a lot about housework and unpaid work as part of the you know, agenda that I kind of encountered as a feminist. You know, I really was, you know, it was kind of all about girl power and, you know, girls can be CEOs too. And again, I support, you know, that. But, you know, like, this question about unpaid work suddenly became so important to me, you know, like because I was faced with it myself and I wanted to know, what have people said about this? So that's when I kind of started looking at, you know, earlier generations of feminists. And one of the first things I encountered was Silvia Federici, who is this one of the women I write about in my book, who in the 1970s, she started the New York Wages for Housework Committee and wrote this manifesto called Wages Against Housework. And that's really what got me started on this path.
It's like so deeply exciting to hear you talk about this. And also, I think for so many of us, like that moment in which you are completely overwhelmed by parenting, you are completely isolated by parenting, and you're also mad at yourself for not being grateful and not like just enjoying the most beautiful thing that's ever happened to you, this amazing little person. I think there's so much guilt and shame about talking about how hard it is to be a mom and how much work it is to be a mom. And so I think there was something deeply therapeutic about your book because it took away that like stigma and shame and just said like, this is work. It is incredibly important work. I wonder if you've run into some level of pushback related to this. You know, I think there was a part of me that was like, I have described my children as like my life's joy over and over again, because they are. They're like these three really lovely, incredible little girls. And parenting is by far the most challenging thing I do. Mm-hmm. And so like the idea of asking somebody to pay me for the most joyful part of my life that is also the most difficult part of my life, I felt like I would struggle to explain that. And then the other thing is, who am I asking to pay me? Like,
yes. Yeah, I mean, those are the big questions. And like, that was part of the controversy to start, right? You know, is like, you know, by demanding payment for something, are you then like making it into like a commoditized job? You know, are you saying, oh, this is like, you know, this is similar to flipping pancakes? And also then, if you're asking someone, I guess it is kind of like flipping pancakes, actually, because that's part of what I do as a mother. But like by asking for payment for, are you cheapening it somehow? Are you, you know, yeah. And I do, you know, that was one of my initial hesitations too, was like, when I'm like taking care of a sick child or reading a bedtime story, do I want to see that as work? Do I want to see myself as having a boss that pays me for that? Like, that feels dehumanizing, right? It's counterintuitive. What the women in this movement would say is that, you know, that's how they get you. You know, it's by telling you, you should do this work out of love. You know, like, and that's not to say that it isn't obviously very loving, but they say, but you know, it's also work that is necessary for the entire economy to function, right? If someone is not looking after children or caring for sick people, you know, our entire society can't run, right? This work has value. So I think it's different than saying we need to commoditize it, you know, like the way we commoditize other things and bring it into this kind of, you know, sphere of, you know, being an employee, but rather that we have to see it and value it in order to actually challenge that system that exploits it, that tells us this is not work, that tells us you should do this out of love, rather than seeing this as something that is actually economically and socially necessary. You know, I think that the experience that you describe, I think some of the women in the movement would describe the kind of emotional blackmail we're under as mothers, where it's like, we know that, you know, if no one else steps in, we'll step in because we love the people we care for, right? If, you know, if they cut the budget and no longer have certain programs for our kids after school, if they, you know, stop providing care for people in our community, you know, like, we'll step in and do that, you know, like, and that's the kind of, I think, real problem that, you know, Sylvia Federici are trying to respond to, is that how does that position of love then become the very mechanism by which you're exploited to give all these things for free without any kind of compensation, you know, like, and it, you know, and which kind of impoverishes you compared to other people in society, you know, who don't have to do that work.
I mean, I think like everything you're saying resonates with me on a really profound level. And at the same time, I think a lot of how we have been told to think about this in a modern perspective is the solution is that you distribute this work evenly among partners and evenly among the genders. Mm-hmm. And I think my sister said something to me, and I've quoted her like a million times. She said, I asked her about her partner being a stay-at-home dad, and she said, he doesn't have the skills for it. She was like, we have been training to take care of babies since we were babies. We were holding babies. We got a baby doll as like one of our first gifts. We've been training for this our entire lives.
Yeah.
The worst thing that could happen is he could do a job that I am really good at poorly and resent doing it. I was like, whoa, that like it changed my mind in terms of thinking about like men can contribute to this work equally, despite not being oriented to it over and over again throughout their lives in the ways that women are. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit about why not just distribute this work evenly amongst men and women and throughout our community rather than compensate women for doing it unevenly?
Mm-hmm, sure. I think we need to do both of those things, right? I think that, you know, one of the things that is really profound about this particular feminist politics is that it's about the ways that women are, you know, oppressed by the expectation of doing this work for free. But it's also about how men historically have lost out by being told that that's not your work. You're not a nurturing, caring person. You know, that's not your job to have these this connection with your children and do that physical labor. So I think that, you know, it's not suggesting that women should do this work and be paid for it, and that's women's work and it's not men's work, right? I think it's about, you know, sharing it. But I think it's also about how, you know, generally, work that resembles caring work is undervalued in our society. We know that it's economically of great value. You know, when economists look at the work that caregiving gives to the economy, you know, it's incredibly undervalued in terms of what it's paid, for example, when it's done for pay. Like, you know, people, you know, who work at daycares, teachers, nurses, like, these people are incredibly vital in terms of, I mean, if you're just looking in economic terms, you know, they keep society healthy. They're why we can all go to work every day. They're why we have future generations of workers and skilled people. And, you know, so, you know, but they're paid less because this work is considered to be, you know, connected to women's work, to housework, you know. You know, when we're talking about, you know, why can't we just share this work among, you know, among couples, you know, assuming that people are in couples, you know, I think the question is more about valuing this work, because I think that we're all working a lot more as households than we used to, with cost of living high. The expectation is that it takes two full-time workers to actually, you know, keep a household going. You know, that's the more common scenario, you know. You know, I mean, my partner and I both work full-time, you know, at our jobs. And that leaves, like, you know, that really means kind of squeezing in the care work around the margins, you know, like in many cases, or that's at least the expectation, you know. So I think what Wages for Housework is calling for is not so much, you know, talking about, you know, who does the work, women or men. It's about actually valuing that work and making more time for it in society. And the way you make more time for it and center it is by compensating it and valuing it. So it's not something you kind of squeeze on the margins like it's a kind of hobby or something, but actually is valuable work.
I really appreciate talking about what it means to uplift this kind of work. And there's a little blurb that I want to read that is, the women of the world are serving notice. We want wages for every dirty toilet, every indecent assault, every painful childbirth, every cup of coffee, every smile. And if we don't get what we want, we will simply refuse to work any longer.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about that, right? Like, you're naming really, this quote speaks to very specific things, right? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
what would it mean to be paid for childbirth? Mm-hmm. I love the idea. Like, were we to stop giving birth, were we to stop mm-hmm. getting pregnant and having children? That's
yeah.
not the end of the economy. That's the end yeah. of humanity.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. that's a really big deal. Like,
yeah.
and yet, pregnancy and birth are expected of women. Women are deeply resented in professional spaces for getting pregnant, for taking time off to give birth to, you know, like, women are often, you know, miss out on professional opportunities, on leadership opportunities because they mm-hmm. have children.
Yeah.
What would it look like to have some level of reverence for the mm-hmm. fact that humanity depends on people having children?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one I've thought about a lot. You know, I work at the University of Wisconsin, you know, we now have parental leave, 6 weeks of parental leave, which we did not have when I had my kids, but that's a great victory, you know, and it's one that the unions fought for and that we have now. But one of the things that really strikes me, and it's, you know, it's 6 weeks, it's not like what we can imagine.
Yeah, I'm just going to come out and be a little critical of 6 weeks of maturity.
Yes.
At 6 weeks, your child has no teeth. Your child cannot sit up independently.
Your like belong to them.
your own body as a person who's given birth has not healed.
Yes.
It feels inadequate.
No, I totally agree with you on that. And like, it's, yeah, absolutely. And like, I mean, getting started on, you know, for people who choose to breastfeed, it's like, that is like hours and hours of work, you know, and like, there's this, the idea that like, oh, you're allowed to breastfeed at work, like, you know, to pump breast milk, like, which is great, but it also like pretending that's not actually, you know, many hours of your day. I'm totally with you on that. I think 6 weeks is honestly pathetic compared to what we should expect for ourselves.
And breastfeeding and breast pumping is literally extractionary, literally extractionary.
Yes. One of the things that struck me, that was actually, you know, and I, one of the things that struck me when I was pumping breast milk at work was, you know, how many extra hours of work it was total, like, you know, because, you know, when you're breastfeeding a baby, that's, you know, hours of your life, and it's you know, it's calories burned, it's all kinds of things that are, you know, and also, you know, it's many things. But when you're pumping breast milk, it's the time it takes to pump the breast milk. It's the time it takes for someone else to give that breast milk to the baby. It's time it takes to clean all the equipment. I mean, it's really like multiplies that work. So to you know, present it like a labor saving device is like not really accurate at all. You know, like, I mean, actually giving you the time to do that work and to compensate it or to support you in it. And maybe people are more comfortable with the idea of support than compensation as a word to use. That strikes me as really, very powerful way to think about these things. But anyway, I was just thinking about how, you know, and my employer, and I don't want to talk bad about my employer when they're facing a lot right now from the world. However, like, you know, I the amazing things that the university is able to do in terms of supporting innovative research and like supporting all kinds of scientific breakthroughs and humanities, you know, brilliant artistic creations. The way they did not know what to do when someone gives birth at an inconvenient time of the semester, it's like, how do we make up for the classes you'll miss? And how do we, there was no solution. Like, I was back in the classroom 2 weeks after I gave birth the first time because I happened to give birth. And then I got to take the next semester off. But it's just the way they couldn't figure that out when they could figure out all these amazing, you know, they're at the cutting edge of all kinds of ideas, but like the very common experience of someone actually like reproducing was something they just couldn't get their heads around, you know, as an institution. I mean, it's really frustrating.
I think it's as a person who's given birth three times and has spent more than 6 years of my life breastfeeding, I think that part of the erasure of that work, of that experience, is making that experience hypersexualized, yeah. And in some ways obscene, right? Like, breastfeeding is not celebrated in our society and is often, held against people in one way or another. And so the idea of valuing work that, you know, people not only don't value, but actually have really negative feelings towards, is pretty complicated, right? Like, we don't have a lot of conversations about birth. We don't have a lot of good representation of birth. We don't have a lot of celebration of women as capable of birth. A lot of times in media representation, a birth is about a doctor saving a woman from the experience of birth. So like, how can I give you credit for something you didn't even do? The person who's getting paid is the expert in the room who's making sure you do it right. You don't know what you're doing, like giving birth and raising kids and breastfeeding. How do we even know you're doing it well or qualified to do it? You know, like, there's so much judgment and hostility towards this kind of labor. And I want to talk about what cultivates that in our society with you a little bit. Like, how, you know, in order to value this work, we have to destigmatize it. And I'm curious about how we do that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I feel like I'm talking to you. You would be like one of the best people in the world I could think of to answer that question. But I guess maybe the question I'll put back to you is like, you know, maybe, you know, thinking about like the wages for housework idea is that, you know, I think that I'd be inclined to say like, destigmatizing and, you know, and recognizing, you know, like, you know, I guess I'm on the tip of my tongue is like saying it's work, you know, like, and part of me keeps coming back to that as the word. And that's, I guess, because of, you know, the book I just wrote, you know, talking about housework. But I think that one of the things that was like really eye-opening to me, you know, going through all this and doing all this physical labor of gestation and breastfeeding, you know, like, was how I just, I'd, you know, I'm a, you know, college professor. So like, I think that I tend to have thought about my work as being this very kind of cerebral thing. Right. And that's where the actual work happens, you know, like, and I think one of the things that really kind of opened my eyes was how much of the work I was doing in that realm was, you know, it just broke down that mind-body thing, right? Because so much of the work is embodied, and it's like, and it's intellectual. It's all those things together. And I think I became aware of just how highly skilled it is, you know? And mm-hmm. like, and that made me really angry at how it's denigrated as something that people just kind of do, you know? And it's something that, like it's really, really highly skilled work, you know, like, so I don't know. So I thought to me, like, recognizing that and maybe calling it work goes some direction towards have valuing it more. But what do you think about that? I mean, I know you're a bit ambivalent about the idea of calling this stuff work because love is so wrapped up in it and you don't want to get rid of the love part of it and, you know, say it's just work. Let's clock in and clock out, you know?
Yeah, I think I have a fear and aversion of making the relationship between women and their children transactional. And yes. I think part of that is because of the work I do in abortion and the desire to turn kids into commodities in court, whether it's through divorce or paternity tests or those sorts of dynamics. And so, you know, I think there's been this debate about whether or not children are property, right? Yeah. And whose property they are and mm-hmm. and who's responsible for them as property. And there's some of this, I think, that makes me worried about that. But I actually think the two of the greatest philosophical questions about this conversation have come up in music. And I think the first one is from, you know, the first thing I'm going to say in response is from Lizzo, and it's why men great till they gotta be great. I think we all need to think about that question every day. Yeah. And the other question is from Billie Eilish. And I mean this in a more serious way. And Billie Eilish in creating music for the soundtrack of the Barbie movie asked what I was made for. And I do think that part of the reason we take the work of birth and breastfeeding and caretaking and nourishing mm-hmm. and raising and teaching and educating for granted is because we have this idea that women are made for it, that mm-hmm. is your yes. purpose, that is your point. Mm-hmm. And it translates to something I think about a lot because I work in education as a member of our school board. And so one of the things we look at is like dress codes. And I've looked at over 200 dress codes from districts across the state. Mm-hmm. And they all ban the same things, right? Like all kinds of clothes that are feminine, you know, and the idea, I think, is like girls are for sex, boys mm-hmm. have sex, right? Yeah. And I think there are so many ways that we reinforce, like, this is what you're for. This is what you should be, and you should be happy to be it. Mm-hmm. And I think deconstructing that is really important. I think it's important in part because I think part of how you get to, like, nobody needs an abortion, everybody's made for having babies, right? Mm-hmm. Is by, like, you'd be amazed at how many people tell me, like, horrific stories of their births and then say, but it could have been worse. Like, mm-hmm. we are not even allowed to take our own suffering and trauma seriously. Mm-hmm. We're supposed yes. to constantly reframe it into how much worse it could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Wow, that's really powerful. I mean, one of the things and particularly to your points about, like, commoditizing, you know, women, like, and you know, with the dress codes and, like, you know, the fear of that. I mean, one of the alternative contrasts, you know, ways of thinking about, like, you know, when you commoditize something and you know, in that way, like, You know, one of the people I'm writing about my book is this woman, Margaret Prescott, who, you know, a lot of her background was in working in the welfare rights movement, you know, and fighting for welfare, right? And one of the, and she was really adamant, and she is today, she's still very active and doing amazing things, including defending the child tax credit, but we can talk more about her later. But one of her really, the things that she really had strong convictions about was that, you know, welfare needs to be called a wage. And not charity. You know, like when it's charity, it's seen as voluntary. The person who receives it is supposed to be the grateful recipient, you know, and that, you know, implicitly puts them at a position of weakness, right? They're seen to be lucky to be getting this largesse and like it should be temporary, rather than calling that a wage, right? If welfare is a wage, that's recognition of the social importance of that work, right? That's recognition that they're not just, you know, like these lucky charity cases, but are actually doing the vital work of society, of raising children, of, you know, confronting structural racism in their communities, of filling in the gaps of the system that fails their kids, right? So like, that's, I think, the flip side of the kind of critique that, you know, this commoditizes you. If you call it a wage, it makes it into this economic commodity. The flip side is, if you don't call it a wage, you know, you can see it as kind of this sort of, you know, this kind of paternalistic kind of charity, right? So I think she would see putting a price on it as a kind of empowering thing in that respect.
I really appreciate that reframe. I think that's so, like, deeply empowering. And I also think, you know, it's kind of a healing framework for someone like me, for someone who identifies as Black and has had the stigma related to receiving public benefits or public assistance is so deeply pronounced for Black women in our society. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. My name is Ali Muldrow, and today we're talking about domestic labor under capitalism with Emily, say your last name for
Kalachi.
Me again. Kalachi. Thank you so much. If you have questions or comments, give us a call at 608-256-2001. We want to hear from you. I just want to pause and give a huge shout out to Mary Jo and a belated happy birthday. I also want to thank Jay, our engineer. You're the absolute best, and your hair is looking really cool today. And then Sarah, our producer. I wouldn't get to talk about this book if it wasn't for Sarah. I also wouldn't have gotten to have like this really nice, like relaxing vent session before the show got started. So Sarah, I love you so much. Thank you for everything you all do. We are, you know, this show is possible because we have a really, really great team. And it's exciting to get to have a conversation about this book. I couldn't help when I was reading your book, and I don't know if this is just because I recently read this, but last fall, I read a book from one of your colleagues at UW about how women became America's safety net, basically saying in the United States, women fill in the gaps for benefits that other countries subsidize, that, you know, women do the work of making sure people get taken care of when they're sick because we don't have universal health care. Women provide the transportation. Women, all of these things that are resourced publicly all over the developed world are made the responsibility of American women and the additional labor that creates. The other thing that your book reminded me of was this this article I read that basically said, as women become more successful professionally, their male partners punish them by assigning them more housework. And you know, thinking about those dynamics and the role of this expected labor, I think that some people would say this work is too precious. Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to pay everybody $1 million? Like, this is the most important work you could do. Yeah. And if you assign it a wage, do you run the risk of not paying people enough for something that isn't as important as this? Could you devalue this labor further by not paying people enough to do it?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. I mean, it is a bit strange to say this work is so valuable we can't actually support it, right? I mean, that's kind of interesting. But I see your point, though. You know, And I mean, I think that, and maybe the thing that is kind of a hang up too is that when we think about wage, it's like, oh, is it going to be minimum wage? Is it going to be $16 an hour? Is it going to be $100 an hour? Like, you know, like how do you actually put a price on that? That's that, you know, is tricky. You don't want it to become another low wage job, right? Like, I think that maybe like another way to think about it though is more in terms of like a more ambitious way of thinking about compensation. Think about, for example, things like proposals for basic income, right? You know, think about things like, you know, the child tax credit, like, you know, support for caring for children, right? A lot of the pilot programs in basic income are actually for new mothers, you know. There's one in Detroit, there's one in San Francisco, these are happening all over the place.
There's one in Milwaukee.
Is there? Oh, that's right. I did hear about that. Yeah. Do you know how it's going?
I don't, but I interviewed someone about it right before. I wish I could remember this person's name. Yeah, Sarah, feel free to throw that in the chat. Yeah. We interviewed somebody about universal basic income a few months ago who was talking about piloting this in Milwaukee. And we should probably bring them back and see how it's going and the difference that it's making.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that reframe of universal basic income, you know, universal healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, giving people the things that they need to have to live in dignity, to live in kind of the most basic dignity.
Mm-hmm. Annie Lowry, you're saying the name in the chat.
Oh, thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So we'll have to reach out to Annie and see how that's going. But yeah, I mean, I do think There is some hesitancy of like, are you talking about an hourly wage? Are you talking about a lump sum? Are you talking about an amount per child? Are you basing it on the age of your children? And then I think there is, you know, is there a difference between a mom doing her family's laundry and a college student, you know, making sure that their dorm is clean and that they're independently taking care of themselves for the first time, or, you know, that kind of question of like, who needs to be compensated and when for what variety of housework?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great question. You know, and one of the things I think, you know, one of the sticking points for the movement itself that I write about in my book is, you know, they get questions like this, you know, which is like, well, how much should it be? Who should pay it? You know, who actually counts as someone doing this work? Is it just for mothers? Is it for, you know, is it for, like you say, college students who are doing their own laundry? And I think one of the things that people found really frustrating was that there wasn't a sort of clear answer, like this much money will do it and then we'll be, you know, then the problem will be fixed. I think the wages for housework, it's both a demand that this work be compensated through things like, you know, benefits for mothers, through things like maternity leave or, you know, things like, you know, support for mothers who are living in poverty, you know, rather than work requirements that come along with a lot of, you know, welfare programs. You know, it is for this kind of, it is a very material demand, but it's actually a much bigger, longer-term demand that we actually reorganize how our economy functions, you know, so that there actually is, you know, time and resources in our economy for this work, rather than, you know, the only thing we think of as worth compensating, as worth, as you know, entitling you to a share of society's resources is that job you do for an employer, right? Why is it that we see that as valuable, but not the work that we do actually reproducing the human race, you know, reproducing society, caring for the community? You know, I think part of what they're trying to do is take down that boundary so that there's more room to support that kind of work. You know, and I think the implications of that, you know, there are a lot to get your head around because it really requires rethinking everything. But, you know, one of the, you know, a few places where this has kind of been, you know, kind of, a few kind of actions that have been inspired by this movement, you know. So you think about, for example, proposals for a Green New Deal, right? You know, a lot of those proposals are talking about how can we, in the longer term, as we try to decarbonize, you know, and find greener forms of economic activity, how can we actually support the kind of work that is good for the community, good for the environment, rather than, you know, rewarding work that is destructive to the environment, you know, the kind of push for more extractive economies, more, you know, like taking things from the earth, more creating more consumer demand for cheap things that we don't need, right? How can we shift towards an economy that rewards things that we're doing that are actually good for our survival? I know that sounds a little pie in the sky, but that's, I think, part of the longer term thing is like not just the demand for money, but how then is that a starting point for rethinking what we value?
But I always think I like have such a hard time about this because I always think we only think it's pie in the sky when it's about treating people well.
Yes.
When, you know, when Republicans say, you know, we're going to force women to have more children by denying their access to contraceptive and to abortion. Yeah. That doesn't seem pie in the sky. People are like, that is an achievable thing. We don't, not only do we not have to pay you to do this labor, we can force and expect you to do this labor. And it's, this book is intensified for me by the fact that we are living in a moment in which I think there is a pronounced part of our nation that really wants to move in the direction of forcing women to have more children by denying them access to reproductive freedom. Mm-hmm. And so in a nation where it's pie in the sky to take care of the people who are taking care of our children, and it is reasonable and public policy to force people to give birth, you know, whether they want to or not, whether they're able to or not, whether it's safe or not. I think like this is, it's a complicated thing to reconcile in this moment. And I wonder how this current political climate influenced you as an author.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I started writing this, I guess, like 2017. Well, kind of started thinking about it then when my son was born, maybe more 2018 or 19. So,
man, those were the days.
Those are the days. But a lot of it was during the pandemic. So, you know, I mean, I started like probably just before the pandemic, really thinking about writing this book. On the one hand, I think there was this real like recognition of care work. We're all clapping for nurses. And, you know, like I remember watching the trash collectors come, and my son at that time like loved garbage trucks. So we go sit outside and wave. And I just like, this sounds so cheesy, but I was just like so grateful that someone was coming, going out there in the world when we were all kind of sheltering, doing this work of like, you know, keep, you know, maintaining sanitation so we could be healthy. So, I mean, the politics of the pandemic really, I think, shaped my emotional arc of this, because I thought, here's a moment, now we're going to really recognize this. Now that like I'm sitting here in a faculty meeting and all of us have kids on our laps, now we're not going to pretend anymore that, you know, our lives only open in the workplace. We're going to actually recognize this, you know, like.
Oh, we have got you a little bit paused.
So many people. Oh, am I back?
You are back. You are back, but we missed a little bit of what you were saying. And it was beautiful because you were explaining how the pandemic shaped your emotional arc for this book and your gratitude towards people keeping our community sanitary. And you're in, you know, these meetings and everybody's got their kids on their laps.
Yeah. And then you have the child tax credit. And I thought to myself, now this is it. We recognize this. We can't go back to a world where we pretend this doesn't exist and it's not important. And then of course we did. Like, I mean, you know, some of the stuff, and it was, I think one of the things that was really interesting about the child tax credit is that, you know, I received it. I think that, you know, like in the past, it was partly because of the damaging stereotypes from the Reagan years onward and the Clinton administration about what it meant to get public assistance, right? There's this idea that's for poor women, right? You know, when you expanded this, like now we all are getting this, and it's like, this is so important. And it's like recognizing this work, we're lifting children out of poverty. And then they cut it. Like, it just blew my mind that anyone could see this as not an obvious good, right?
Right, you know? And it also, like, once we had it, it's like one of those moments where you're like, wait, we can afford this. We can afford to do this.
Yes.
We can afford to take care of each other. We don't have to pretend that we don't have the resources to invest in families and children and moms and kids. It was pretty, it was heartbreaking.
It was heartbreaking. I remember seeing this op-ed. I can't remember the name of the person who wrote it, but it was an economist from Harvard. And, you know, I think he was from Harvard. He went to Harvard, but it was in the New York Times. And it was something like, you know, arguing it's good that we're ending the child tax credit because it's a disincentive to women for working outside. And I was just like, it blew my mind that anyone witnessing the pandemic and what parents and caregivers were going through could suggest that supporting women in that work or parents in that work was somehow going to make them lazy. It's like that was just like so offensively wrong to me.
No, I feel like I had this like a parallel moment in relationship to education, because we passed these two incredible referendums during the pandemic and at a time when kids were not going to school in person. And yeah. I think part of the reason we saw more enthusiasm for yeah. that referendum than we have ever seen for any other was that all of a sudden people were like, I would pay any amount of money yes. for you guys to like take these kids back and yes. figure out how yeah. to get them back in school. Like the amount of, you know, my kids were so excited to go back to yes. school. They were like characters from Matilda. They like wanted to go to yes. school so yeah. badly. And it was like not having it made us aware of how much it means to us. And
absolutely.
Yeah, this idea that you have to incentivize things, I think it runs in theme. What you just said is thematically similar to what my producer, Sarah, just posted in the chat, which is she's seen a post by the Heritage Foundation saying defunding higher education would be good because higher education has kept women from starting families.
Wow. That is grim.
Yeah. Like we want women to be less educated and to, yeah. you know, have as many babies as possible.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Grim times. Yeah. I mean, it seemed like things were, I don't know. I guess I think to start, you know, you started off by saying it seems like things have not actually gotten better in so many of these key areas. And I think that, you know, what we're in for right now is, you know, is really bad.
No, do you feel like you're a few days away from Gilead? Like, do you feel like Handmaid's Tale is happening?
I don't know. Yeah, it's a great. I mean, I feel like that metaphor gets up somewhere. And I read that book so long ago, but in terms of like, especially the J.D. Vance, like the at first I'm like, this is so weird. Nobody is going to actually like this is going to discredit him when he starts talking about like this pronatalist stuff and you know like. You know, anybody who has an opinion is like a childless cat lady and we have to like tear them down and make us all into, you know, birth machines. Like it's so violent. You know, I feel like, and I think often like times, you know, people, if you don't actually follow through the implications of what he's saying, you miss how violent it is, like coerced birth, coerced pregnancy, coerced parent. I mean, it's just, it's horrible, you know? So that to me is like, I think I expected that to discredit him in the eyes of the public more than it has. And the fact that he is currently just spouting his nonsense, I can't swear in the air, is like, you know, that to me is like really scary. So yeah.
Yeah,
so
I mean, I think I've stopped being... Like, I used to be really disturbed by Donald Trump. I used to be really disturbed by, like, these specific political figures. Yeah. And more, I'm not. I'm disturbed by the people who subscribe to them. I'm scared of how many people are excited yeah. by this messaging and feel like, you know, like... The world is, you know, I think there is this embracing of like, the world is out of order. Women don't know their place anymore. People yeah. of color don't know their place anymore. And we need to get them back in their place so that yeah. we can have a safer, healthier, happier society. Mm-hmm. And that message is, I find that to be terrifying. And yeah. I also think the people who embrace it, I have a hard time understanding. And so there's this huge like disconnect of like, you know, I think there's this nostalgia for a time period in which a person like me had absolutely no rights. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why, outside of the fact that a person like J.D. Vance had all the rights at that yeah. time. And yeah. and I don't understand why we live in a society that would want to take your and my rights away and so many people's rights away mm-hmm. to make somebody like J.D. Vance and Donald Trump more powerful than they already are. Because let's like yeah. not kid ourselves, these guys are not losing. Like yeah. they're not in charge. They're just yeah. not as in charge in ways that are cruel and violent and horrific towards other people.
Yeah.
But me having autonomy in relationship to my own reproductive freedom doesn't stop somebody like Donald Trump or J.D. Vance from exercising their own autonomy or authority or leadership. It doesn't, obviously, it's not getting in their way. So, yeah. So why are they so threatened by it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just old fashioned, patriarchy. I don't know. It's hard to, the persistence of it is really, really hard to understand, but yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think about it. Donald Trump is somebody who was born in the 40s. And in some ways I think about a person who was born white and male and cisgender and straight, mm-hmm. really longing for what that used to mean in terms of supremacy in comparison to other people. Mm-hmm. But then, for the folks who voted for him, who for mm-hmm. the most part are not billionaires and yeah. did not inherit, half of Queens or Manhattan or whatever, I don't get how these folks fit into it. And I think that is the part that's really complicated. I think when I was reading your book, the other thing I thought about a lot was Phyllis Schlafly, who was really like she was this pronounced housewife, except she wasn't. She had this mm-hmm. massive career and this incredible education. And
yeah.
But she was really, she made a name for herself by saying, we don't need equality for women. We don't need yeah. women's rights. And so yeah. how do you navigate the divide among women, whereas you have women who go, this is labor and we should be supported and we should get the child tax credit and no kid should live in poverty. And
yeah.
and then
yeah.
you have women who say, this is our duty. This is, mm-hmm. This is God's plan for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I found really troubling to think through was when, particularly like in my view, horrendous ideas that, women, need to leave the university and go and just have babies, right? That kind of talk. Like, the thing that I found really troubling is how it seemed like at certain moments, in certain ways, that belief was trying to claim terrain that I feel like we on the left need to claim, which is support for that work. Like, not that, your gender determines who will do that work, or that that work is compulsory, or that there's something naturally feminine about it, but that we're going to support that work. Like, that a Republican, and I shouldn't know, but that this particular Republican tried to claim that terrain, like, made me feel like, what is our response? Like, what is our response in terms of actually saying, like, we do not buy into that misogyny or that, that ideology, but we do support robustly care work. Like, I feel like that terrain needs to be seized on a little more. It really kind of broke my heart to see in some way the right trying to seize that,
Yeah, I feel very similarly to that. And I think your book is so powerful. I think Wages for Housework, the story of a movement, an idea, a promise, is just the kind of book that you go back to over and over again. And so I'm wondering what you hope people take away from this book. We've got just a minute left. So as quickly as you can, what do you hope people take from your book, Emily?
Sure. Well, I hope they find it interesting, and I hope that it makes them, invites them to think about the role of unpaid work in their own lives as caregivers themselves and as recipients and beneficiaries of care. It connects us all. So I hope that people can think of themselves in relationship to these politics.
I hope so, too. And I hope that people think about, like, I always say, the thing about a mom is if you're not one, you got one, right? Like,
yes.
And so, like, If this doesn't apply to you, like, my parents are married to this day. My mother made every single doctor's appointment for me. She signed me up for every like soccer team. She's the best. I love you so much, Julie Jean. She's making food for my kiddo's birthday. And so I hope, like, what I thought about in this book over and over again is all of the labor of the women who've come before me, and how grateful I am to them. I'm so grateful to you, Emily. This is a beautiful book. was such an honor to get to talk to you about it.
Thank you so much. And I so appreciate you ending by talking about your mother's labor. That is the perfect, thought to close on. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you to everybody who listened to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm your host, Ali Muldrow. This is A Public Affair. Stay dry out there on this rainy Wednesday, my friends.
Be reported, disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it live and direct. We come and never pre-recorded with an admission that would never be reported.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, Letters in Politics.
Never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
I see parallels between the way the labor movement was targeted in the 1940s and 50s, right, and the way higher education is being targeted today, in the sense that these are two sort of institutional bulwarks of progressivism and progressive thought, right? The labor movement is weak today, in part because of the persecution of previous decades, but now a lot of conservative and authoritarian energy is being directed at higher education because that is seen as a bastion of liberalism, the left, wokeness, whatever you want to call it.
Today we're in conversation about the second Red Scare of the 1950s. Our guest is Michelle Chen. Michelle Chen is a journalist and a postdoctoral fellow in history at the Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. Donald Trump has insisted talks on a ceasefire in Ukraine are on track after he held an hour-long phone call with President Zelensky. Mr. Trump described the conversation as very good. The US president said most of the discussion focused on his call with Vladimir Putin on Tuesday. Sarah Smith reports from Washington.
The most notable aspect of Donald Trump's reaction to his conversation with Mr. Zelensky and yesterday's call with Mr. Putin is how measured and diplomatic he sounds. There have been no loud boasts of his success written in capital letters on social media posts.